This is Building Bridges, and I'm Ken Nash.
I'm Mimi Rosenberg, and later on, Biden, a drillin' and a shillin' for the fossil fuel industry, and a frackin' and a crackin' the earth of federal land. Say it ain't so, Joe.
First, we speak with Robert Pollan, an economist at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, founding co-director of the Political Economy Research Institute, PERI. Pollan's most recent of many books was co-authored with Noam Chomsky and is titled Climate Crisis and the Global Green New Deal, Political Economy of Saving the Planet.
Talk about that melding of why a Green New Deal, if you will, actually makes economic sense as well as an imperative for SOS, saving our planet.
I started to get into this topic about 15 years ago, and I myself was almost totally ignorant around issues of climate. I hadn't done any research. I hadn't integrated it into my work. But as a kind of down-the-line, lefty, macro-type economist, it finally the light bulb went on that I said, I can't keep doing this work and not integrate the climate crisis, especially, as you just said, Mimi, because all I was hearing was, we have this massive trade-off. Yes, we can defend the environment. We can address climate change. But if you do so, that means, you know, massive losses in terms of job opportunities and incomes. And that was really exactly the question that I started researching, because it didn't make sense to me. Because, I mean, on the other hand, we hear, for example, all the time in defense of the military budget, well, you know, whatever one might think about U.S. foreign policy or U.S. imperialism or whatever, military spending is good for jobs and the economy. And so why couldn't it be analogous that investing in defending the earth and saving the planet is going to be good for jobs and incomes? And that's basically where I started. And it's a really simple point. Actually, over this course of 15 years, it's kind of become, at least in its large sections of the population recognize. I mean, for example, this Build Back Better program that Biden had advanced and Bernie Sanders before him, that's the basic premise of it. True, it hasn't passed, but it, initially the term for it that Biden had given it was the American Jobs Plan, and it was climate and other social spending. The climate was the centerpiece. And it was the idea that, okay, we're going to invest in climate protection, saving the planet, and that is also good for the economy. It's actually pretty simple in its basics.
Now, in terms of doing both of them, it takes a while for the climate jobs to get on board. So what do we do in the meantime with the oil economy, and how do you fit those two together?
Well, it doesn't take a long time. If, for example, we hire people to undertake energy efficiency retrofits of buildings, which is very first thing you should do, especially when we have energy prices, fossil fuel energy prices going up, why not make buildings more efficient? You can start that in a week or 2 weeks. And, you know, you could do it on a massive scale. You can do every single public building in the country right away, and then you end up saving taxpayers money. Of course, it's not a one-for-one match. It's not, you know, if you're working in an oil rig, you're not going to be able to just jump into doing a building retrofit and think you're going to have the same standard of living. That's true. But there will be an abundance of jobs, and the minute you start investing in building solar installations, wind turbines, energy efficiency, electric vehicles, public transportation, you'll get the jobs. Now, at the same time, you will phase out the fossil fuel jobs, and that is a big part of the story. But a lot of the research that I've done with my coworkers here at PERI show that even in West Virginia, where I did a study, the green agenda along the lines of Build Back Better, somewhat more ambitious, but along those lines, would generate about 25,000 jobs in West Virginia. Whereas the phasing out of the coal industry, you lose about 1,200 jobs a year. So even in West Virginia, with our friend Senator Manchin, the green agenda is good for jobs. Of course, he's not going to tell you that. I know he's aware of my study because I presented the study to his staff. That's the reality, and we just have to keep telling the story over and over again until it penetrates.
You made a presentation to Joe Manchin's staff. How did that come about, and what brought that into being, and what was the reaction?
I was commissioned by a wonderful group, Reimagine Appalachia, and they are working in West Virginia, also in Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Kentucky, exactly on this issue of energy-dependent or fossil fuel-dependent states, heavily fossil fuel-dependent states. How do we revive their economies? And of those four states, most certainly West Virginia is the worst off and the most heavily dependent on coal. So I wrote the study, and then they were the ones that got in touch with Manchin's staff. I think, you know, they have pretty good representation on the ground in the state, so you have to listen to them. You know, you can pretend to listen to them and ignore it in terms of what you think in terms of policy. But, so I met with the staff, and I thought they were going to be pretty aggressive and hostile. It was just the opposite. They were, the staff were very supportive, very curious. They actually read the study. They had a lot of really good questions, and they said, we want to follow this up with hearings and so forth, and that's the last I've heard of them.
Well,
why are we not surprised?
It is true that Manchin, shortly after I made my presentation, he did a press conference with the head of the Mine Workers Union and the head of the
Cecil Roberts. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so in that press conference, he said, you know, he didn't mention my study per se, but he said, I am all in favor of this just transition for the workers in our state. And, you know, I'm for the green investments and we have the just transition. But again, that was all talk. What he really has done is simply defended the coal interest and his own particular personal coal interest. And that's what has, you know, just destroyed the momentum around this.
Now, let me ask you, you've put forth a proposal to nationalize the three largest oil producers in the country.
Yeah.
Why would that be something that is better than another route?
I don't know that, you know, given the real world politics, I don't know that it's that much better than the idea that's in Congress, which is a windfall profit tax to tax the high monopoly profits that the oil companies are getting now because of the supply shortages in the Ukraine war and their monopoly power. But if you follow the logic and you just say, look, the oil companies shouldn't be getting these obscene profits. What are they doing? They're not doing anything different than they used to do. It's just that we had COVID, so there were some shortages, and then there's a war, and they're taking advantage of it. And so they are, you know, they're squeezing the population. So you could say, well, that's really illegitimate and immoral, that what they're doing. But if you follow the logic, you say, well, actually, why should oil companies get any profits from selling us a product that is destroying the planet? So that's really the key idea. Now, is that politically realistic? I would like to think so, but, you know, frankly, I don't think we're anywhere close to getting something like that passed. But I did want to at least put it out and say that, look, this could be done. During COVID, the Federal Reserve pumped $4 trillion into Wall Street. You could buy the biggest three oil companies for one-tenth of what Wall Street pumped into, what the Fed pumped into Wall Street. So it's and during the last crisis, the federal government bought General Motors and Chrysler. So it's not out of the realm of any historical precedent, and it's the most logical thing to do. I mean, how can we deny at this point that we are in a spiraling, deepening climate emergency all over the world, including in the Northeast? So on what grounds can we justify companies making huge profits off of selling us the very product that's destroying the planet.
There haven't been enough collective demands, even notwithstanding a million people here and there that have come together in demonstrations, but there hasn't been that consistent push. But it is my belief that it is the working class, that it is people from these industries, these fossil fuel industries and so on, that can begin to do things like write into their contracts the phasing out of the use of fossil fuels and the retraining of the work staff for clean energy and so on. And I was wondering what your thoughts are about the role of organized labor, and have you seen any real movement there to adopt a climate justice perspective?
There's been tremendous inspiring movements in the labor movement. You know, I've done these studies for different states. In two cases, in the state of Colorado and state of Washington, I was commissioned by the AFL-CIO, just the mainstream headquarters, the leadership of the state labor movement. They were totally supportive. The most inspiring has been the work I did in California. It was endorsed by 22 unions, including the union that represents the oil refinery workers. And the leadership of the Oil Refinery Workers Union, one of the leaders, Norm Rogers, has been really upfront and outspoken on behalf of a climate transition, just transition program. He had a brilliant article in the Los Angeles Times last fall. He was a spokesperson at the Glasgow Climate Conference. People should recognize that against really stiff odds, a lot of people in the labor movement have come around and are leading communities around climate justice issues. This is a really critical development because, again, the premise that got fed into us for, you know, decade or two is this is bad for jobs. It's a bunch of environmental crazy snobs, don't care about working people and their standard of living. And the leadership of these environmental labor coalitions have fought against this and with considerable success. I'd also mention one organization that has been really in the forefront here called Labor Network for Sustainability, led by former union officials, and they've really taken on this job. And in my view, that's the single most important way through which we are going to get some big breakthroughs, because if you have, for example, in the state of West Virginia, you have the opposition, obviously, of the oil companies that feed propaganda. And they are the ones that are telling the workers, you know, the environmentalists don't care about you. They're going to destroy your livelihoods. On the other hand, if you then get a significant labor presence arguing on the other side and fighting for just transition, that's really going to turn things around.
In the minute or so we have left, as to the imperative that brought you to the work that you do now on climate justice, on SOS, saving our planet, and maybe the final premise of your book that you co-authored with Noam Chomsky, Climate Crisis and the Global Green New Deal, the Political Economy of Saving the Course. Just a minute, final message.
Just being a human being, all you have to do is follow the news. Like I said, I feel like I came to this late. I wasn't a specialist at all on climate, environment. I was doing other stuff. Like I said, after a while, I just couldn't, you know, a lot of what if you do in macroeconomics, like the big picture economics, is how do we move the economy forward? How do we create jobs? If you're a leftist, how do you do it in a way that's just? How do you build in union power and all that? So those are the kinds of things that I worked on for a lot of time. After a while, I just said, how can I keep doing this and not pretend like there isn't this climate issue? And so I said, okay, I'm going to stop pretending. And now what? So that's kind of how I got into it. If I can get into it, you know, fairly late in life, I think anybody can at this point. And we see before us, you know, the dire situation that we are in at present. Is only getting worse.
These issues, they're of essential, fundamental importance. And we have been speaking with the wonderful Robert Pollan. His latest book, climate crisis and the global Green New Deal, the political economy of saving the planet. Thank you for the work
Thanks
that you do.
Much.
Here to talk with us about the findings and recommendations of their new report, Averting Climate Catastrophe, Fossil Fuels Must End While Renewables Take Over, is Thomas Mayer, National Organizing Manager, Food and Water Watch.
And I want to start by Biden. Biden stated repeatedly and unequivocally that upon taking office, he would halt all new leases for a drilling and a shilling and a cracking on federal lands. This action does not require the declaration of a climate emergency. He could have done it on day one. So, Thomas, where are we at, and why am I being so cynical and sardonic about Joe Biden?
You and me and many others who are paying attention to this issue have been disappointed in what the president has done so far. And I think a big part of that is because of the gap between promise and reality. We knew that Biden was not going to be the ultimate climate savior, but he was really pushed to take some more progressive and necessary positions in the campaign and even during the transition. And one of the biggest ones, like you mentioned, was ending fracking on federal lands, ending offshore drilling. These are two areas where the executive branch, in this case, the Department of the Interior, has very clear and longstanding, you know, authority and jurisdiction to manage those programs. And so those were promises that we in the climate movement had pushed many past presidents to make, and to have him saying that in the campaign and in the transition was great. And then it hasn't happened, and it hasn't happened, and it hasn't happened. In fact, the leasing to oil and gas companies and even the encouragement, the vocal encouragement that oil and gas companies use their leases on federal land has continued. So that definitely contributes to, you know, a big feeling of disappointment. The good news, though, is that at least on, or I should say especially on the offshore drilling front, the administration has a big opportunity to wind down the production of oil and gas on federal land. So every 5 years, the Department of the Interior is required to make a new five-year plan for the offshore leasing program. And that 5 years has come up this year. So they just released their draft plan. It includes up to 11 lease sales, 10 in the Gulf of Mexico, and one in the Cook Inlet of Alaska. If all of those 11 were to happen, it would be disastrous. The one piece of good news, though, is that Biden and the Secretary of Interior, Deb Haaland, were very clear that the other option, or the other end of the spectrum on that report, would be zero new leases. So the draft is, you know, basically 0 to 11, and the final is not done yet. We're in the middle of a 90-day public comment period, and so the administration does still have a big opportunity, and one that is very clearly, you know, within their jurisdiction, as you mentioned, without declaring a climate emergency, to actually not issue any new lease sales over the next 5 years and start to wind down oil and gas production on federal lands and waters.
Your report also says that President Biden should use his authority to stop the construction of new fossil fuel infrastructure, including liquefied natural gas exports, by denying the needed federal permits. Could you amplify what that means?
Yeah. So, again, this is another area where different federal agencies have very clear authority and jurisdiction when it comes to permitting. So, for example, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers has to issue permits of a variety of types for major infrastructure projects. So that could include a major pipeline or refineries or export terminals, just depending on the specifics. If there's a federal permit required, at some point in the process, there's going to be a federal agency involved. And Biden could direct his federal agencies to either in a piecemeal way or ideally in sort of a broad way to reject permits for fossil fuel infrastructure projects. For a long time, the climate impacts have not been considered or considered adequately as a part of environmental impact statements. In fact, the environmental impact statement for the previous five-year offshore drilling plan didn't include climate impacts at all. It basically said they would be negligible, that the oil that was extracted and burned would have a negligible environmental impact, which of course is preposterous, and we're seeing that, you know, the evidence of that fact every day. But Biden could, with the science in hand, direct his agencies to reject those permits for new fossil fuel infrastructure projects. There are some really clear examples right now. The Forest Service and the Fish and Wildlife Service both have to consider permits for the Mountain Valley Pipeline, which is about a 300-mile gas pipeline that goes through Virginia and West Virginia. Those permits should be denied, and that pipeline should be stopped. The Department of Transportation is considering a rule, actually whether to either extend or revoke a rule from the Trump administration that allowed the transportation of liquefied natural gas by rail, which is not only bad for the climate by incentivizing more fracking and natural gas extraction, but it's also incredibly dangerous because the process of moving liquefied natural gas by rail is to pressurize an already volatile compound and put it in a rail car and ship it through neighborhoods and, you know, communities all along the railroad. The Department of Transportation should absolutely revoke that rule and not allow LNG to be transported by rail. Those are just a couple quick examples that are sort of timely, but like I said, Biden could quite broadly direct all of the agencies that are, that report to him to reject these kinds of permits.
You know, it's fascinating because I'm working with groups of people now that have been discussing abortion liberation clinics on federal lands and the fact that there's very little substantive in any of the edicts that Biden has put out relative to prohibition, which is tightening and having worse and more frightening implications for larger groups of people, particularly poor people, people of color with reproductive functions. It's just incredible. So we've been advocating for training people to come in and use federal lands to set up abortion clinics as a way of making it also clear politically that the federal government supports this. Your thoughts on the paradox there. But here they want to, of course, set up pipelines that would transport liquefied natural gas with all kinds of possibility of ruptures and other things. Just your own thoughts on the contradictions there.
Yeah, I mean, another parallel I'll point out is on the issue of fracking specifically, which was quite fraught for Biden in the primaries. He seemed to think that being against fracking was going to loosen the state of Pennsylvania. From that same state, there's more and more evidence that fracking and the chemicals and the pollution involved in fracking is especially detrimental to pregnant women and to young children. And so there's clear parallels and, you know, and intersections between environmental issues, environmental justice issues, and women's, you know, bodily autonomy and health care. The other clear point of intersection is just the kind of illegitimacy of the Supreme Court at this point. I think the Biden team is very, very hesitant to challenge what they view as sort of the long-established legal constraints that a Supreme Court ruling sets up for the administration. One of the responses to our demands for a climate emergency is that it would be immediately challenged in the courts and it might be struck down, or that other executive actions would be similarly challenged. What we are seeing, and certainly what, you know, myself at Clean Water Watch and many of the groups that we work with, we're part of a coalition of over 1,200 organizations called People versus Fossil Fuels that has been pushing for executive actions and the declaration of a climate emergency since day one of Biden's first term. We really know that people are desperate for action on climate and a range of other issues. And, you know, as the negotiations in Congress sort of dragged on through 2021, through the end of last year, through this spring and summer, we didn't see much from the president in terms of executive actions and the powers and the actions that we know he could take without Congress. And so, you know, I hope we're sort of at an inflection point where, you know, it's so clear that Manchin especially has not been acting in good faith and that the obstruction in Congress is too much to overcome, at least right now, and that the Biden team might be open to actually using the sort of broader set of powers and authorities that they have. But the same is true on other issues. I think, you know, what Congress has done in the last couple of years is not a lot. The Supreme Court has certainly constrained that in other ways, too. And so I think people are really desperate for the administration to kind of take charge and show some leadership on a range of issues. And climate is really at the front of people's minds, as so many people are experiencing a heat wave and wildfires and other things right now in the summer.
Give us a sense of why fracking is so damn dangerous and liquefied gas pouring through our federal lands. Why should we demand that Biden stop fossil fuel extraction on federal lands and stop the construction of new fossil fuel infrastructures, including liquefied natural gas?
Well, fracking is a really dangerous form of drilling for oil and gas that really took off under the Bush administration when it was exempted from things like the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act, and the oil and gas industry was really able to run roughshod over communities all over the country. Food and Water Watch was the first national organization to call for a ban on fracking and work with many allies to keep fracking out of New York and Maryland and other places sort of in that initial boom of the fracking wave. Chemicals involved have been linked to maternal and natal health issues, really just a wide range of quite scary health issues and environmental impacts. People setting their water on fire, you might have seen videos of that in the past decade or so, became kind of the norm in areas where fracking was happening. Biden seems to be at an inflection point right now where congressional negotiations have kind of petered out. Call the White House, write the White House, you know, check out Food and Water Watch and People versus Fossil Fuels to get involved. And we are going to be pushing even harder for Biden to use executive action to declare a climate emergency. And everybody should get involved and demand that Biden take action right now.
Thomas Mayer, it's always good when people come together and organize for righteous purposes, for clean energy, against environmental racism, and Food and Water Watch, and your work is instrumental in that. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash.
Then this has been Building Bridges, and that's what we do. Workers of the world, unite. You have nothing to lose but your chains and a world to win.